Maurice Lachapelle, Reel 3. Did they discover how it had been hit to cause such catastrophic damage?
The bomb hit in front of the bridge and went down a hatchway, and of course it went straight down through, sort of an open hatchway, right down through the bottom and blew a big hole in the bottom of the ship. We were on the way down, when we were marching down to the ship, the IAF were allowed to go in front of us. And, you know, we know and said, well, why should they go first? We're senior to them, the Army senior to the IAF. But they got on the ship first, fortunately for us, because they, and unfortunately for them, because they were down the bottom. They were in the bottom holds, or the bottom accommodation. And of course, they had, they were practically all wiped out, all the IAF, because they were down the bottom. No one could get out. That was a problem. But it filled up so quickly. Quite a lot of the crew were lost as well, of course. But I've spoken to one of the survivors who was down below, one of our survivors, and he said it was absolute chaos because there was just, he got up some steps for one of the crew showed him these stairs or ladders, and they climbed up these ladders to get out. It was part of the crew's. From the engine room, and they showed them where to go, and they managed to climb up these ladders to get out. But of course, everybody couldn't do it. It only takes so many at a time. I mean, they try to get out the porthole, they try to get out of everywhere, but they couldn't. And it all happened so quick. Within 20 minutes, it's gone, completely gone. And that was at, 10 minutes past four on June 15th.
In the afternoon.
It was calm, it was peaceful. It was calm, the aircraft had gone, and it was sun shining. Fortunately, it was nice and calm, and which helped us a lot. If it had been rough, it would have been a lot worse off. But fortunately, it was calm, and
And you managed to get away from the drag of the ship as it turned over.
We got away as quick as we could, you know, and sort of dog paddled and tried to swim as best I could. It's because we were told to get away from the ship, get away from the ship, you know.
It must have been an awesome sight seeing it just.
Oh yeah, just
settling.
Yeah, I can see it now. Yeah. It's it's something I'd want to go through again. And that's why when we meet up for our pilgrimages, it's nice to meet up the old friends who went through that together. And of course we had a lot of chats and things. But we never talked about it afterwards. We were told not to and we didn't. We just, people said, well, why didn't you? You know, it's all. And we were, said, you've got to think this was wartime, where everything was more strict and controlled, and if you were told not to talk about certain things, well, that was it, you didn't do it. You didn't sort of flout the law or instructions, and it wasn't until the first news of the ship came out, so one of the crew had gone on another ship, who'd been sort of transferred to another ship, and he was in America, and he was spoken to by some people from the American radio, but he certainly sport on service, and he said, oh yeah, I was on my own castle, got sent. Because a little bit of it came out then. It was some of it was published in the Daily Express, I think it was, I've got a cutting. But it sort of was hushed, you know, forget it, it's all gone now, it's all done. It never had any publicity at all until the year 2000. That's when it really came out, the whole story came out. That was our 60th anniversary. But it's great to meet up, it's great.
So, to take you back, you were all put on a train to go to London.
Oh yes, we were sort of half kitted out, a motley army, we were. I mean, there wasn't a kit available because a lot of it had been given to the people from Dunkirk, which happened fortnight, 2 weeks before this, so there wasn't the kitting available. We got to Luton, we got on the train, we finished up in Luton, put into various church halls and things, for billets and empty houses, and then we were kitted out there properly, you know, we managed to get some sort of uniform. Then our officers joined us. This was the first time we'd seen most of our officers, except for Captain Abbott. Then they said, we're not going to have you marching up and down in the local park with broomsticks, pretending, you know, you're going through the motions. We were put in Vauxhall Motor Works, being old tradesmen, we were put in Vauxhall Motor Works to help production there of army vehicles. It was doing all army vehicles then, all Bedford Army trucks. And we went in there to work, which was lovely.
This is the Bedford OY?
Yes, yeah, all the old Bedfords. This was what, 1940, wasn't it? Yeah, 1940. So we weren't, when we joined the motorworks, the job I had was at the end of the production line, we had to start them up and drive them around the track and park them up in various places. But the trouble was they were coming off the line with various parts missing. They had no handbrakes. That was one thing. Or different, they had no tailboards. Whether it's made in different factories, made in Bond, or of course they haven't got back up to. So then when all these stores came in, we had to go out and fit all the stuff into those trucks and things on these big parts outside. We enjoyed it there. The union said that they wanted to pay us, that the firm should pay us the same rate as they were on. Of course we said, oh yeah, that's lovely, you know. I think we were on about £3 a day, you know. Yeah, we were doing very well. We were on £3 a day then. Lance Corp. Yeah, £3 a day, I was on. But the military said no, the CO said no, you can't do that. If you try and do that, I'll withdraw all my troops out. So they said, all right, we'll have a subscription. So they should have a WIP line in, because we were boosting their production, so they were getting a bit extra. So they were giving a few bob extra each week. It was great. And we used to have our meals, midday meal in the canteen there, and we used to watch the different shows that visited these factories and all that. And we said we couldn't have two dinners because we had tickets. So we used to have our ticket and get a meal. But we couldn't get two dinners. But we used to sit through the two shows, the two sittings. And it was lovely, we enjoyed it there.
Who did you have come? Like Wilfred Pickles and.
All that sort of stuff, yeah, all these shows touring around the country, giving. Boosting morale for all the workers and all this.
And did the Lancastria seem like a bad dream?
Yes, we were beginning to push it at the back of your mind to try and not think about it. You know, we didn't talk about it amongst ourselves. So we tried to, you know, sort of box it up, I suppose. That's what we did, really. Because while we were there in Luton, Luton Airport was just up on the hill, and we'd come out to the canteen that evening, it was tea time, and we sat on a big, all rows and rows of steps up to the canteen, and we were sat there, and we were watching these aircraft, all of the aircraft taking off up there, and suddenly we realised it was German aircraft, it wasn't ours, you know, it was theirs, and they were bombing. So we laid down on the steps, you know, we thought, well, what's the best thing, laid in these steps. And they came over and they bombed the works right through, and they hit the foundry, which was opposite where we were shelter. And all the smoke and everything, so, oh no, yeah, you know. And there was smoke and flames and screams and all sorts going on. And then, because we were waiting to go back to the unit, you know, be marched back. And then they came to us and make the wrong way back through the rubble. I really go back to our billets in the town. And it was absolutely horrendous. As we started walking down, there was legs, there was arms, there was all sorts, you know, from the bombing. And it really churned us up and upset us a lot. Everybody went dead quiet, you know, because it all flooded back again from the ship. And We eventually got back to our boats, and because they dropped a string of bombs right across the town, and there was no glass in all the windows of the boats. They'd all been blown in. So we had to collect up the blankets and all the boat and glass and get rid of this before we could do anything. So they wouldn't let us go back into the works after that. We had to go down to the bus station and repair the local buses, because the workers couldn't get in because the buses were off the road, so they had to go down, start repairing and patching up the buses so they could go out. And we did that for quite a few weeks. Then we went up to High Wycombe, set a workshop up there. We were repairing engines there that had been salvaged from a ship that had been sunk, this one lot we did. And then that's when I got the posting order. I was with Alan all the time. And this is when I was introduced him to his wife, Jane. And Alan and I were still some fun together. And,
so you were still obviously going out with your now wife?
Well, yes. We could watch the raids on London. And we got posted then Middle East. We had to go to the Middle East.
So when was this?
That was in 1941. August 41 we sailed, roughly. But in the meantime, we were given 7 days embarkation leave, which we went home, did all the inoculations, and then we went home, we had 7 days leave. I went home to the wife's home. I didn't go to my home at all. I went to her home, my mum. And I met all her sisters and brothers. And I had 7 days in there. You still have to have more inoculations while you're on your leave. You have to do that in your own time. And I'd got to Millwall in London the other day.
What did they inoculate you against?
Everything, I think. I don't know, it was all concoctions. We used to get TAB, tetanus, all sorts. We used to knock us about for a couple of days, you know, maybe rough, for a couple of days. But that's right, when we came back from leave, and then we went up to Bedford. No, now it's all Bedford. Went up to Bradford. We were assembled all in Bradford, ready to go abroad. We were just going abroad, that's all we knew. We went overseas. We weren't issued a summer trip until we got on the ship. Then I managed to get a 48-hour leave. And I went home. I got home on the Friday night. We were married Saturday afternoon in the registry office in Ealing. That's right, in Ealing registry office. I went back to my unit Sunday morning, and I didn't see the wife then for another 4.5 years.
Amazing.
So went straight out. Because we went back to that place in Bradford, and then we went up to Gourock, and then we were living on the ships there in Scotland, and then joined up with a huge, huge convoy.
How did you feel getting back on another ship?
Not very nice. Bring back the memories. And then, of course, to make matters worse, we got on this thing, once we assembled out in the Atlantic, it was massive, massive. Like, you could see ships everywhere. But the thing we were on, at least had lectures and talks, and then we were issued a summer kit. We thought, hello, we're going somewhere warm, you know. I mean, it didn't tell you anything. And then the ship would break down. It was suddenly dead quiet. And then the action stations, I used to think, no, life jackets on, get up on deck. You used to stand up on deck, dead quiet, it was all quiet, you know, no engine gun, because you could hear the engine when they were running, boom, 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 boom. And then a destroyer used to come back and circle around. And one time it came back when we broke down, it was shaken by a loud hail, you know, but it went off. And then it came around and started dropping depth charges, and I thought, oh no, I've got this far, I want to go further, you know. But it all went well, and we stopped near Freetown. Some troops came to shore at Freetown, and we carried on down to South Africa, to Durban. It took us 6 weeks to go up to Durban. And
did you go on shore at all at Freetown?
No, we ended up shore. We were offshore, you know, all the ships were out to sea. It was just a couple that went in the offload troops. And then we got to Durban. We had a week in Durban, and we changed ships there because this one wouldn't go any further, you know. I mean, I should have pulled the plug on it before it went on this trip. And
what did you think of Durban? Was it a different world?
Oh, it was absolutely totally different. The lights were on. Everything was all wonderful, just like the old times, you know. Cool, it is. And we were getting fruits and all this sort of thing. It was really lovely. It was. You would have thought there was any problems in the world at all. And we managed to stick it for a week. We survived that for a week, that day. Then we sailed on another ship. Of course, we were crazy onto another one, which made it more crazy than ever. And we sailed up through the Red Sea, up through the Suez. What? That was when we joined the Desert Rats.
Did you disembark at Port Suez? Or?
Yes, Port Suez, yeah. And went by. Where did we go from there? I went by train. It's a little bit hazy. I went by train and we finished up in a place called El Amarillo. Sorry, El Amarillo. And we opened the workshop there. That's right, Amarillo. Yeah, we opened the workshop there. Of course, we were dealing with the Long Range Desert Group and all the old, all the lads from up the blue. And then,
what sort of vehicles were the Long Range Desert Group using?
They had jeeps, I think it was like a jeep. And we were fitting extra water tanks. We were fitting extra this and fitting extra things. Because they used to go off completely independent. They wore, they didn't wear proper uniforms, a bit of an Aussie uniform, a bit of this uniform. Very nondescript they were. Real scraps, we thought, you know. And I mean, they lived in the desert on their wits, and we used to repair the vehicles and do all these other things. And they'd go off into the desert doing all sorts of things. Wonderful, really. Yeah, like LRDTs, Long Range Desert Group. Yeah. We stayed there until Alamein, and they pushed back to Alamein. And we really were up against it when we had to move from there. We went down to the...
Did you come under attack?
No, unfortunately, I was unscathed. I was all right from there. Went down to the depression, I think it was called. It was a big wadi place where we holed up there, ready to evacuate, down in, right into the desert, right down south.
Did you sleep in slit trenches?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you slept rough, you know, as and when and what you can. And you had to be extra... guard duties and this sort of thing.
Did you have a lot of problems with the local Arabs stealing stuff from your depot?
Oh, yes, they'd steal your bootlaces if you didn't knock them. You know, I mean, they'd take them out your boots without you knowing it. We lost, the one period, we were on the canvas and we lost two tents with the men still asleep in them. They were still asleep and they woke up and the tents had gone and nobody heard or saw a thing. It was amazing. They were real good Clifty Wallers they were called. They'd pinch them. They used to, if a truck was going out the stores, you always had two people in the back. Because they'd jump on the back of the truck and offload it before you got to the other end. They'd pinch them. One period we had, in our workshop, we had Arabs doing a lot of the dirty work. We were getting, once Alamein was started, we started getting all the damaged vehicles back and tanks back, and we had to open them up to the sealed. We had to open them up and take all the ammunition and stuff out, ready to go into workshops, get them prepared. And, you know, you're trying to boot with a foot still in it, and all this, you know, it was a bit gruesome. But you got used to it. But the wogs was to send the wogs in and get the ammunition out. I shouldn't say wrong, should I?
I understand from ex-Desert Rats that means worthy Oriental gentleman.
Western Oriental gentleman, that's right. Yeah, and we used to have to search these blokes every night, you know, and because they'd take anything. And one night, the lads were all lined up through, and there was a sergeant, and and we were stood behind them. And if they found anybody with, which they suspected had something concealed, they'd send him back to us. And the chap said, "We've got something, Sarge. It's all right." So he came back, and I made him take his galabeer off his nightshirt off, you know. And then he had another one underneath that, so I made him take that off. And he had like these big pantaloons on, these big baggy pantaloons. And I said, "Take him off." And he took one pair off, and he had another pair underneath that. I said, "What's going on?" So I started searching him, and felt underneath his crutch. And I thought, "You've got something hidden up there, mate." And with that, I said, "Come on, offer these." You know, we all had sticks. You know, you weren't supposed to hit them, but you gave them a gentle tap occasionally. And eventually, I got him take his pants off, and he bandaged himself up. And I said, "What's this?" And he told me that he was very sick, and had to be bandaged up. I said, "Well, take them off." But as he was loosening this bandage, a revolver fell out, a loaded revolver fell out. So I nearly grabbed him and hit him, which I should have done. And I hit him in the face. I knocked out two of his teeth and split his lip. And I thought, "Wow, I'm in trouble now, because you're not supposed to hit them where they can be seen, you know." So I called one of the officers over. I said, "I just caught him with this loaded revolver." I said, "In self-defense, I hit him, or it paid him up to the MO," he said. So we got him in a truck. Of course, he was bleeding. Got him up to the MO and explained to the MO what had happened. So he stitched his lip up and charted his teeth out, took him back, and we sent him on his way. But never saw him again. But that was the sort of thing they'd do, you know, they'd pinch him in. While I was there in the desert, another job I had was I found was interesting. I was met by an escort of Gurkha regiment, the officers and the troops, fully armed.
I didn't know they had Gurkhas in the desert.
Yeah, they were there. The colonel used to come to the sergeant's mess, well, sergeant's tent, and I'd ride in the truck with the officer, the Gurkha officer. We'd got to the POW camp. It was about 5 miles up the road. And we'd pick up 100 Italian prisoners of war. I just had to count them out, check them out. And then we'd have to march them back to our workshop where they were employed in sorting objects. We're getting a lot of vehicles over in crates from America. And they were sorting all the timber out, knocking the nails out, straightening the nails, because everything was so short, you know, I mean, you had to stay there. And I was to pick up 100 every day. I did that for a month with the Gurkhas. And the Italians used to complain because they'd be marching along, and of course one wanted to stop and spend a penny, and the Gurkhas were just fully armed, the rifles and bayonets fixed. They'd just give them a jab and get them back into line. They weren't allowed out, they weren't allowed to move. And I never lost one in the whole month, never lost one. One or two had punctured bottoms, but with bayonets, but apart from that, it's, yeah, that was quite interesting. They were very nice to the lads, the Gurkhas. I complained to their officer because the lad that was up on top of the truck at the back of the machine gun, he had the safety catch off and his finger on the trigger. And he was looking right up through the column. And I thought, if anything happens, he goes over a bump, he's going to knock off. Quite a few of those, you know, and I asked the officer if he could put the safety catch on, you know. "Oh, no. I said, "Yes, I'll have the safety catch on. I don't mind him escaping, but I'm not having him shot, you know." So they agreed in the end, all right, just to be safe, you know. That was good, yeah. Now, when all Alamein finished.
What sort of morale did the Italian prisoners of war have?
They seemed resigned. They didn't need an armed escort, really. If you just said, right, for 50 of them, like, "Come on, you're coming down this way," they'd all come, you know. I don't think they'd have escaped. A lot of them gave up and marched back on their own from the front, you know, from different places up in the desert. You know, perhaps one military policeman in charge of 1,000 Italian prisoners of war, you know, marching them back. They didn't want to escape. The war was finished for them, you know, it was lovely. They were glad to be out of it.
It must have been quite a logistical problem for the British Army to look after that many people.
Well, when I actually got to this POW camp, the Germans were in one part. They wouldn't allow those eight to walk at all. They were But the people that were looking after the POWs, they were people who'd been injured during the war. I remember there was one sergeant who had lost an eye, another one lost an arm, you know, and they were in charge of the POWs, and they were the right people to be in charge of them. They kept them in order, you know, mate, you've done this to me, so, you know.
Did you ever cannibalise any of the Italian and German vehicles for use for yourselves?
No, this is rather, I can't we had some medical supplies that were issued, which were Italian made. If you went down to the medical centre, you could get an issue of Italian made ones, you know, condoms. And they were used later on in waterproofing. They were used on battery terminals and battery, you know, the vehicle batteries, where the screw caps were. You should put them over the top of their waterproofing.
Some people use them on the end of their rifles too, don't they?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, what was that? Well, from there, when Alamein sort of was nearly finished, the day, I was moved down by, I went by train, and I finished up in Beirut in Syria. Went by train, that was a nice journey, that was. I enjoyed that. 3 days it took us to get up, through Palestine, well, Palestine as it was then.
Was this a sort of jolly, or for work?
Oh, no, I was posted to a workshop in Beirut. We were up there because the Vichy French were playing up in Turkey and all that, and they were worried that they would come down from that side. So we were up there as a base workshop, plus I think it was a battalion of troops up there. But they kept changing our divisional badges to make people think there were all these different divisions up there, so every month we'd have a new divisional badge. Never knew which division you were in, really, you know. But it was all part of the make-believe. That was nice in Beirut. We had a very sticky session when we were getting ready for Sicily landings, and we were doing all the waterproofing and preparing the vehicles for the Sicily landings, camouflaging and waterproofing and all that sort of thing. We spent a lot of time working then. I mean, we just carried on until you dropped and get a break.
Did you have a lot more American vehicles to look after then?
Yeah, lots of American vehicles coming around then. Dodges, I remember Dodges.
GMCs?
GMCs, yes.
Willys?
But once the Sicily lands were over, we were more or less redundant up there because it all quietened down in the area around Turkey. And we were less sat back and enjoying it. So they organised swimming, you know, trips down to the beach for swimming, and we played tennis at the American University in Beirut. And all this, Alan came up. He was in Haifa. Alan was in Haifa, and I was in Beirut. So he came up. We stayed in the Salvation Army hostel in Beirut. We had a week together there. That was a nice week session we had there. But, you know, we still swimming, we had a lot of fun there. And then, what happened to that?
Did you used to get letters from home occasionally?
Yes, they came through, I suppose, like, you get 3 letters and then you wouldn't get anything for a month. You know, I suppose it depended on shipping and this sort of thing. But it was lovely, you know, to get a letter from home. I was writing every day, every other day, you know, this sort of thing. But you couldn't say too much, you couldn't say, because they're all censored, you see, they're all censored, all the letters are censored. So I caught dysentery while I was up there in Beirut, and I was in a hospital for 6 weeks in Palestine, and that was rough. I went down to about 6 stone. You know, it's mine, I wasn't the only one. We were given tablets, I think they were called MMB tablets. MMB, I think they were called. And you either had to keep these, once they diagnosed, you know, it was just you started off with 2, then the next 2 hours you had 3, and then the next 2 hours you had 4, and the dose increased the dose until you had about 5 or 6 at a time. it was really, really horrible. And if you couldn't keep them down and cope with them, you then had to go on injections. And the poor chap next bed to me, he was like a pincushion. You know, they'd been injected everywhere and anywhere, you know. But I was in the hospital for 6 weeks there. Yeah, it was rough, that. But I went back up to Beirut on convalescent, and then I finally joined the unit again. And I was on guard one night. I was in charge of the guard party, because a lot of stuff was missing from the unit. They were breaking in, and we said, four unmanned patrolmen.
The Arabs again.
Arabs again. They were armed. They had what we call one up the slope. You know, they had one that was ready to fight. And they came in one day, and went in one barrack room, and they cleared all one side of the barrack room with everything that they wanted. They took all different things, money and AB-64 part ones, repair books and these sort of things. Everything they needed, they took. Left everything else. And nobody...